I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like. I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like. Hey, hey, what's up, world? Welcome to another edition of I Mix What I Like Live. Again, I'm Jared Ball. Happy to be your host. Always a pleasure to do these live streams and interviews and discussions and presentations. And I'm definitely appreciative of all those who are here and will be here live and those who will see this later. Definitely appreciate you checking this out. Please make sure you are subscribed to imixwhatilike.org so that you don't miss any of the variety of work that I and my colleagues and comrades do across a cross multimedia beyond these live streams. And of course, sign up here, subscribe, like, share. Please invite others to join us and consider clicking that join button and becoming a member of the channel, because in a very short period of time, we'll be announcing an expansion of the channel with many more people being involved, an expansion of the projects and the work beyond just this particular show. And the more support we have, the more we can expand and the more we can do. And all I can say is, before getting into details, the project is not to put money in anybody's pockets. It's to expand primarily a journalistic and media project, investigative journalism, media production, all emanating from, at least initially, the Black radical tradition, which is my own and our collective starting point. So anyway, please consider checking that out or consider joining and helping us build. So we will be continuing to do our work here around political imprisonment. So that will remain a feature, and we'll be bringing others in short period of time on to talk more about that. But please go back and check our work with Safiya Elijah, Karanja Carroll, and others. Of course, Daruba Bin Wahad around specifically with Safiya around the Free Sundiata campaign. Daruba Bin Wahad is himself a former political prisoner and someone we stay in regular contact. And of course, Karanja Carroll is helping us do well, and increasingly so, we hope, with regular reports and conversations building from his own work around political prisoners. And his most recent visit was a discussion about Asada Shakur, beyond the Asada Taught Me slogan. So anyway, absolutely. Thank you very much. B-SPAN is in effect. Yes, we're very much looking forward to talking to our next guest about the Ujima People's Progress Party. And it's somebody actually I've spoken to with going back a number of years, and somebody whose organization and efforts I've been trying to support for a number of years. So I am very happy to talk with him about what we're going to do in the next coming years around electoral politics. But just before we get to that, I have to say one more quick thing about what's coming up here on these lives. And if you go to the channel or imixwhatilike.org, you can get the full rundown. But we have a number of exciting guests coming up, including later on today. We're going to be talking with Dr. Kemet Shockley, currently of Howard University, who has with one of his colleagues created a new series called The Movement, which is going to be airing very shortly on WHUT and PBS. I had the pleasure of being one of the several interviewees, but we're going to talk with him about that. And we're also going to talk with him about how he is one of the co-founders and I guess co-founders and creators of the classic debate to which we refer all the time between Kwame Ture and Dr. Malefi Asante at the University of Cincinnati. And so we're definitely going to talk with him about that and how he and I remain, you know, very friendly and good colleagues, despite the fact that we are on opposing ends of that debate and the sides of that. And so we'll have a very interesting, another very interesting conversation with him about that as well, as we've done that with him previously. So please come back for that. We have Dr. Norman Finkelstein is coming Sunday night. There's going to be a fascinating discussion. We're going to talk a little bit about his work, obviously the Holocaust industry, his new work, I Accuse. We're going to talk about some of his forthcoming work and just in general, his career. I'm looking very much forward to that. I'm endeavoring a number of different interviews that have still not yet been fully scheduled. Dr. Sut Jali is coming up, legendary media scholar. I know that we've just sort of working that out, and we're also going to be talking about, of course, working out a couple interviews around this. Hopefully, in the near future, the GameStop, you know, Reddit, Wall Street scandal crisis, which obviously relates a lot personally, you know, to my work around the myth of Black buying power, in terms of, well, just a lot of the myths around how the economic system works and how it's arranged and the role of public policy. And there's a couple of interviews I'm trying to get locked down. I'm very, very much struggling to get locked down around the financial system, beyond just the GameStop issue, because, I don't think I even realized this. Did you all realize that beginning earlier in this year, I didn't realize the numbers were this big, that the Federal Reserve has given well over $19 trillion to the financial system in Wall Street, which is just shy of what the pre-COVID GDP of this country was at $20 trillion annually. So what I'm trying to look more into and invite more discussion of is this in fact the point that I was trying to make in the book in the myth of Black buying power around the role of not only public policy but this not only and then of course the mythology and the phony comparison between buying power and GDP, but also what might be a tactic in terms of how the vote could be used to develop public policy and campaigns around redistributing the GDP, which through public policy, which is in fact, if I understand more and more, and I'll continue to try to learn more, was done just over this past year. In less than a year, that much has been redistributed to the top, you know, firms, and specifically even like the top 14 banks, not all of whom are even here in the United States, but are so wrapped up with the economy here that the Federal Reserve here had to infuse trillions into banks overseas to make sure the entire financial system didn't collapse, or at least that those who run the financial system got all the money that they were expecting to get, regardless of COVID, regardless of shutting down people's businesses, regardless of shutting down people's access to healthcare, employment, et cetera, and so forth. So I'm definitely wanting to look more into that. It's so much more than obviously something around GameStop and a few hedge funds losing some money, or maybe not. So anyway, but there's so much to get to. I forget that this is a bit longer of an intro than I had intended. I'm very much interested in bringing up our next guest. He is the spokesperson of the Ujima People's Progress Party organizing committee, which is a genuine grassroots community effort to build the first Black workers-led electoral party for social and economic justice here in the state of Maryland, and I think as a model going much beyond the state of Maryland. And of course, I'm talking about Brother Namdi Lumumba. Welcome, brother, back to the program. It's always good to see you. Thanks again for joining me, and good morning to you.
Uhuru, good morning, brother. Thanks for having me to have this discussion.
When you respond to this initial broad question, feel free to add anything if you like that you know, reflects on what I've even just said in the introduction. But if you would, just tell us a little bit about the Ujima Progress Party and what its history is and what it is intended to do. And then I definitely want us to talk about what we can do with electoral political politics going forward. But again, what is the UPP?
Yeah, so every state has these different awkward rules, right, about how individuals, how groups can participate in the electoral process. The truth is that electoral politics is not for working class people. It sure as hell is not for Black, brown, and oppressed people to have any real substantive change in our lives. If that was so, the 1965 Voter Rights Act would have transformed, at the very least, our local governance, right? The way local government looks. And in parts of the country, especially in urban cities, where Democrats control local city, you know, local state power, you would have the ability, you would assume, to make real changes, right, in the lives of Black people. The problem is that we don't understand clearly that elections are not struggles for democracy, it's struggles for control of the state, usually by the ruling class, right? As long as capitalism is dominated over the economic system, as long as there's a capitalist class that is wealthy beyond people's imagination, right? Beyond people's imagination, as long as that system is in place, the electoral politics is not set up to make a real difference in people's lives. And it's sad because so many people, just a few months ago, we witnessed people crying, right, to see some old capitalist agent get put into office, one who we've already known his history as being anti-Black and an imperialist. For so long, Black people have engaged and hoped that these things would transform our lives. And what we don't understand is the struggle around the split in the ruling class, right? This crisis in capitalism that they're calling a crisis in democracy, where the fascist forces, the far right forces are building. They don't need to win a damn election to do what they do, right? And we have to be aware and informed that winning elections don't necessarily mean that that's the end of our struggle for power. So how we get to the Ujima People's Progress Party? This actually was an idea that got started around the Obama administration, just as he was winning. Coming into office, and literally we saw the Black community go through all kinds of, you know, release of grief and pain. We saw people who built their record as Black nationalist leaders who for decades had decried the electoral process, white supremacy and all of that. And all of a sudden, with the emergence of Barack Obama, give him a chance. His family is beautiful. No substance discussion about his policies, about our influence over him as a voting bloc, none of that, even within the context of a democratic process, right, let alone the liberation struggle. And so coming out of that, it took some time, but people started to see, wait a minute, Black men in office, even at the highest stages, does not mean things are going to transform, right? And so we said, okay, we need to be able to engage in a new way in this electoral process, because what has happened is really spent since the 70s. We saw that the ruling class that had its pick of the Black middle class, which has emerged as a leadership class in our community. And they have had all the space to run for office, to win electoral seats, right? And to literally be the operators for local and international capitalism at the expense of the Black community, especially Black working class people. And the revolutionary forces, which were so strong in the 60s, had been pushed back, had been murdered, had been pushed out of the country, dissipated, were now on the outside looking in. And oftentimes we were left to have to do demonstrations on the outside of the debates, right? Even during the Obama administration, the election period, if you remember, there was a brother who stood up and had a sign that said, "What about the African community?" Right. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't even tolerable to even have a damn question about what would you do for our community if we voted for you was not allowed in that space. And they eventually shouted him down. Well, it's hard to shout you down when you're on the debate, if you can get in the debate. It's hard to deny that you exist and that your political and economic positions exist. Even if your chance to win is like a snowball's chance in hell, you can't stop me from being able to say what needs to be said, right? And so we would have to come up with an idea, and this is the formulation of how we started to come to create, Ujima People's Progress Party, right? And I just want to quickly say those values were important because we said that we had to build a party that was anti-imperialist, that was anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and anti-sexist, that supported the struggle of working class people, believed in self-determination of oppressed people, and believed that there could be liberation, right, for people not based upon exploitation. That's the basis of where we start. And now we can have this discussion about what the Ujima People's Progress Party is, you know, day to day, year to year, elections and all that.
So before we get to some more of those details, I want to ask one more question about the sort of branding of the party. That is, you know, why the name Ujima? Why do you have the particular language, if you know, workers led party, you know, not just black, but worker led party? You know, why are you in front of a red, black and green flag? You know, why, you know, what is the relationship of all of this to what it is you're trying to do, to the extent you haven't already explained that?
Yes. So Ujima, for those who are into the Kwanzaa celebration, it's a basic principle, right? Collective work and effort, right? Collective work. And we believe that this collective work represents what working class people do every day, right? And that the leadership of our community as a black community has to go beyond the black middle class, especially since it has a clear history, not only in this country, but internationally. It has a clear history of being a comprador class, a neo-colonial class, a misleadership class. That black workers, which make up the vast majority of our population everywhere, this state, this country, this world, right, is that we have to now build an institution that develops us and puts out not only our issues forward, but our leadership and organization styles forward. So that's the name. The red, black, and green is clear. We're tied to the National Liberation Movement of African people. This on this continent and in the continent of Africa itself, African people have to have their own self-determination that we define. How it will come out, I can't tell you right now, but I know it's a discussion that we must have. And you can't be prepared to be in a process if you don't build organization, if you don't educate yourself, if you're not aware of what these questions are, right? What is that? We are part of an international struggle to defeat capitalism and imperialism. We have to be. You can't build, I think history has shown us, you can't build national independence, right? And think that the forces of capitalism aren't interested in everyday thing that you do, your resources, your people, the markets, all of that. So you have to be a part of a much broader liberation discussion about defeating capitalism, international capitalism, right? And I think the most important thing that also came out of this is the concept of a black worker-led party. So there are really two parts to this. And I said, we've been around really for over 10 years. Some of it has been engaged in electoral politics, but we cannot limit ourselves to electoral politics, and we haven't. The real question is how do you build working class power from the bottom up, right? That means engaging people on some of the struggles that they deal with, food, clothing, housing, and being in education, police brutality, and building the answers from a working class point of view that don't go to forces that have historically benefited from these kind of relationships. But in saying that, we're going to also build a party that's going to be an electoral party in the state of Maryland. Anybody can join because it's an electoral party. You have obviously want to unite with these principles, right? But we've made it up front that the black working class will be the core leadership of this discussion. We will never abandon the interests of black working class people and other working class people, right? We don't want to be transformed into a black version of the Democratic Party, or for even better sense, we don't even want to be turned into a black brown version of the Green Party. We want to be centered around the working class interest, the class analysis as it affects African people in this country and around the world.
So maybe we'll come back to all of that. I just want to do this real quick, because I have to admit I'm mad that I'm late to this, and I'm trying to catch up to learn more of these details. And I've even endeavored to reach out to the authors of this article, because I keep thinking that when I'm thinking, you know, about electoral politics and what it might lead to. And I know we're not just talking about voting and getting black elected officials, but I can't help but have to point this out because it's so fresh to me, at least. And again, I admit I'm late, because this article came out, I think, in April of last year. But I just want to look at this. But my point very quickly is that the distribution of not only is the way wealth is created, but how it's distributed is all public policy. that theoretically could be impacted if we were electing people out of parties and platforms like Nnamdi, what you're describing out of the UPP, theoretically at least. And I'm just thinking how fascinating, how amazing it would be, for instance, if Nnamdi Lumumba was involved in the discussion, as was to your point about even the Green Party, but as was people from even supposedly the most left of the Democratic Party, like AOC and Bernie Sanders and the rest of the squad. They all supported earlier last year the distribution of the wealth as it went all the way to the top. And then only belatedly came back to argue for the rest of us, and of course lost. But anyways, but just this first paragraph here from December, and this is going back, so this was written in March of last year, and it's talking about the post, what happened after the so-called last crisis. Okay. From December 2007 to November 10th, 2011, the Federal Reserve secretly and without awareness of Congress funneled $19.6 trillion in cumulative loans to bail out the trading houses on Wall Street. Just 14 global financial institutions received 83.9% of those loans, or $16.41 trillion. A number of those banks were insolvent at the time, and did not under law qualify for these federal loans. Significant amounts of these loans were collateralized with junk bonds and stocks at a time. Anyway, so I misread the dates when I was talking about this earlier. So it wasn't talking about what happened last year, but this is very I didn't misread. Okay, so I'm glad I checked this live. I was probably rushing, should have done this beforehand. But similar legislation was passed over the past summer in terms of the CARES and HOPE Act, in terms of distributing about $5 trillion to those same entities. And my point here is that if we had theoretically somebody like Nnamdi Lumumba or others situated, their vote could be cast for the legislation to be policy to be developed that would distribute those kinds of that kind of wealth to working people. All they did was create policy that distributed wealth, some created out of nothing, to the most elite, most wealthy, to keep afloat. Just as they did this past summer, the most elite financial and Wall Street institutions, and while the rest of us are left with nothing, all of that is public policy. It's not anything other than that. So, anyway, do you have any response to that? I don't know, or any thoughts about that. You don't have to. I have many other questions for you, but I just and I admit I was rushed a little bit and threw all that together. Just even this morning I was looking at some of this stuff and trying to figure out all this GameStop stuff, and some of the background. And when we get to some of the interviews on that, man, I don't know if you've been paying attention. I mean, it is really some wild. I mean, the people involved. This is some shady. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead, man.
I'm going to try to respond to that also. And I'm also seeing some really good comments in the chat. But quickly,
okay, good.
The nature of elections, right? Let's not do American exceptionalism. Let's talk about what in social society of human beings, why do we have elections? Mm-hmm. Elections are struggles for control of the state apparatus by contending forces in the ruling class, right? Mm-hmm. Because capitalism isn't a homogenous force. It has contending interests. Finance capitalism, manufacturing capitalism, real estate, all of these different sectors of capitalism want to have control of the state apparatus to control public policy that makes it better for them to make more profits, right? So when you have a discussion like what you just said, we have to understand that because you control the state apparatus, you in broad daylight now can stick the people up, right? And now codify the law to say, yes, this is how we're going to transfer more wealth to other sectors of the capitalist class. But listen, the struggle that we're seeing now between the far right, there are sectors of capitalism that believe in the national discussion, right, around how capitalism should be internalized, how it should ignore other forces in the international capitalist market. They help fund Donald Trump's campaign. You see other sectors of the capitalist class who put money in the Biden campaign. It's not even secrets. I mean, these are open discussions that you just need to look at to see what sectors of the ruling class supported what political ideas and agendas. So this is what we're talking about. You have to have working class politicians who, if they're in office, who have to be conscious of this fact, right? What are our class interests? How do we intervene? How do we stop this? I mean, damn, you got to have working class politicians, if they're in office, who are willing to like flip tables over, if somebody believes in that story, flip over some tables and get arrested because you're not going to participate in the robbery of working class and poor people anymore. Damn if that's what you want to do, right? Make it untenable to rule for even in those places if you have a kind of base that you need to build to get elected.
So is the UPP trying to become a national party? Are you endeavoring to expand beyond Maryland? Or are you trying to model what other Black communities and other states can do and do it that way? Or
Yes.
What are you trying to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's what we're talking about. Obviously, on the state level, and we really resisted, quote unquote, expanding, because the truth is, it's contradictions trying to make this happen. There are contradictions that make this happen. Some of it's state level and some of it is organizational capacity, what the masses are ready for. But we've always been in contact with other forces that are emerging around the country who are trying to do exactly the same thing, right? We're engaging them all the time. I think there's going to have to be a part where we can't stay fractionalized like this. We have to be able to come together and say, what is it that we need to do to build a working class electoral party that represents Black people, right? And we've even been approached by other forces outside of the African community who want to have this discussion. And we've talked to them, but we cannot give up our independent struggle and our need to have self-organization. It's a part of the process. We have to be willing to have a national party, right? But it comes from the bottom up, which means at the state and local level, we have to build capacity.
Right on. I mean, I've always loved your approach, and I think because I think it's the best way. I mean, obviously coalitions have to be built if you're talking about electoral politics, because just numerically speaking, you have to. But if that is engaged on the basis of prior organization, with the prior establishment of a platform and candidates and campaigns, then I think it can happen. How does the UPP deal with the question of gender, sexuality, and sexuality-based exploitation and oppression, specifically within Black communities?
I think this is a really, really important question. And I think it's going to be one of the most transformational questions for our community. The fact is that at the very least, there are more people who are non-men, right, who are oppressed, who are African, by their system of imperialism, colonialism, and capitalism. And if that majority is not a part of leadership and having real control over the movement, then you're not going to have a liberation movement. We can't build a movement of liberation that is on top of gender exploitation. We cannot. And we are open to that question. And I think we are ourselves being evolved by the discussion. It is an internal discussion that we are always talking about. I think we continue to learn about that. I think as men, we actually have to take our own ownership, not of just our individual relationship. Listen, our whole community is impacted, not just men, but women as well, right? We all believe in some of these fallacies of patriarchal systems and all that. We've been indoctrinated with that. But specifically, men have to also check each other, right? We have to have a process in place. You can't expect people who've been indoctrinated for 18, 20, 30, 50 years of this, crap to also just all of a sudden flip. So we have to have processes in our organization. We have to have real leadership that's backed up and supported. We have to have processes that teach men and women how to relate differently, right? But we also have at the core understand that a system of expectation, I don't care if it's Black capitalism, white capitalism, any system that is based upon exploitation of human beings by human beings is going to produce this kind of problem.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I agree with Ian entirely with the framing of this question, but the question here, George Jackson says, participating in electoral politics to win gives credibility to the system. Does UPP mean to win in elections or use their position to expose and disrupt the system? Just to clarify, even though it is the Ujima People's Progress Party, you all go by UPP, not UPPP, right? Just, I guess, for brevity and ease of flow, right? Just so we're clear. And my maybe disagreement is only around if what I remember from George Jackson is that he said we need a three-pronged approach, an underground political party, whose goal it was to, an underground secret army, rather, an alternative political party whose goal it was to popularize in part the idea of revolution, and an alternative press. So maybe Ian's point here, specific to trying to win, is maybe where he's wondering what you're where you know, is maybe the semantic difference we're dealing with here. But anyway, are you trying to win elections, and are you trying to give credibility, or do you think this effort gives credibility to the system?
Certainly. So first of all, again, I always preface this: we cannot use American exceptionalism to describe political phenomena, right? When Hugo Chavez came to power through the electoral process, was he giving credibility to the system of capitalism in Venezuela, right? It's a struggle that he was engaged in, a struggle that he didn't live to see, but one that continues even in today, right? So our big question for us isn't whether we win or lose elections, it's do we win power, right? The electoral process has been defined totally by the bourgeoisie. Right. So their definition of winning an election is you have to have more votes and therefore you get in office to do nothing. Right. Here we are in Maryland, a state that is run by the Democratic Party. Here we are in Baltimore City with no Republicans on the city council. What would it be possible if one radical politician wins the election? What policy are we going to get through? What struggle are we going to be able to win as a part of that body? Right. That's realistic. So we have to understand that the struggle isn't to get on to win an election per se. It is to win power. If you can run an election and build 100, 200, 300 new people into organizational capacity around food, clothing and housing, and you lost the election, then you just win power. What we have today is a model that even people who are tied to organizational capacity. Right. We run elections. And we say what we have to say. And then after the election, we, you know, everything disperses and there's no consolidation of that base. Right. We have to fix that. We have to train ourselves. We have to build organizational capacity that teaches people. No. Every name that you get, call those people back and get them organized. Damn, win an election. Matter of fact, 2 or 4 years later, you got a base. So when you run somebody else, you can go back and say, we have power to put people in office. Right. We have to have a long term view, not just short term view. We're in a struggle for power, not just to win elections.
So to that end, what is the sort of day to day of the UPP? How do people get in touch? You know, what is it like once you become a member? Are there, you know, meetings or monthly, weekly? What projects, programs? What is the day to day building of that organization looking like?
Yeah, certainly. So, you know, we're involved with community type of activity. Mutual aid has obviously been very much needed, especially with the COVID-19 crisis going on. Being able to help communities get necessary food, PPE materials, toiletries that they need in their community has been a big part of what we're doing. The comrades who've come out of that work are now looking at having a community refrigerator that's available in the community. Take what you need, give what you can. That's free to the community. We're working on a Gloria Richardson community gardening project. Sister Gloria Richardson, who is a native of Maryland, who's still alive, who, you know, really set a strong example. We're looking at how do we build a network of family-oriented, food plots, right? How do we teach ourselves to feed ourselves? I don't expect a garden in your backyard to feed your whole family, but it also helps when times get a little tighter. Maybe you want to trade what you grow, your tomatoes, for somebody's watermelons. We can also do things with ourselves that don't need the capitalist system, right, for us to maintain ourselves. We also have a political education process, which is really, really key, right? Civics education, which is like mass-based for the communities, something that we had planned in 2020 to actually go on the road, if you will, go to community associations, go to schools, and have a presentation that would give people a quick working-class intro to civics, right? Because civics is gone in most public education, and even when you got that, it was a bourgeoisie's version of what civics was supposed to be. We have political education for people who join the party, who want to have deeper discussions about economic systems and systems of exploitation. What does liberation look like? You know what I mean? All these kind of questions that need to be asked. You need to develop a cadre, right, that can not only answer these questions, but implement these answers. So that's how people can get involved. Obviously, things that pop up like police brutality. We're involved with the housing complexes. The public housing right now is an issue in Baltimore City because really the city doesn't want it anymore. But the communities are rallying together. There's leadership there that needs to be supported, educated, and uplifted with resources so they can fight back. And that's an important struggle. John Hopkins University tried to actually get a hold of some influence over some of these public housing situations, right? Because John Hopkins right across the street from public housing, right? They offered their own private police to police their community, a private police which has no, no authority over that community, no accountability to that community. Who do you talk to if it goes wrong? Who do you fire? You know what I mean? None of this was, but this is what they offered to us as a solution, right? When in fact, people need more community control of the police. People need community control of their housing, right? Not these answers that really facilitate capital and what people are trying to do to push Black and brown people out of the city, right? So those are the kind of struggles that we're engaged with. We always invite people to check us out on our Facebook page, our uppmaryland.org, which is our webpage. But you can find us on Facebook and get involved with that process. Even if you're remote, we invite people to participate in our political education process. We're hoping that people get inspired and in their state start a very similar process, and hopefully we can help them.
I'm kind of stuck for a second. I'm not up on this issue either. So I guess it's the same old thing. Baltimore's trying to get rid of public housing, poor Black residents of the city, essentially. And Hopkins is participating, and part of their solution is not jobs or economic redistribution, but private policing. Is that what you're saying?
Of course. And what happened was it all comes to the question of what is safe for their staff and their students, right? Now, most people already know that they already have their own security. And you can see that in and around the community where the university is and the university campus, and also where the hospital is already their own security. But what happened was they used that as a reasoning for needing more police themselves, actual gun-carrying law enforcement forces, right? That they said Baltimore City was over capacity, couldn't handle the crime situation, and that they needed their own police force. And this was supported by members of the city council. It was eventually decided that they could have their own police force. And so today, there is an armed, wing of the state that is not accountable to any of taxpaying citizens, right? That is accountable only to John Hopkins. And so John Hopkins, right across the street from John Hopkins University, is this prime real estate in the middle of the city, Douglas Homes. It's a historic public housing complex that's been there for years, for decades. And they would love nothing more than to get access to that and to turn into housing, right? Update the housing. And they've done it on the other side of John Hopkins. They've taken whole swaths of communities and turned it into upscale housing. So now they would love to get this, but they said, no, we're not interested in that. But clearly Baltimore City has already said it's out of the public housing business. It's no longer giving out any more vouchers, right? Housing that is in bad shape. They are moving families out, to Baltimore County and to the surrounding suburbs. And so it's a part of depopulating the very large Black population in Maryland, right? And so this is just ongoing process that they did, right? But them offering the police is, I mean, come on. I mean, we know that police don't stop crime. You want to stop crime, give people education, give people healthcare, give people access to resources they need, right? To create their own economic institutions. That's how you solve the problem of crime. And John Hopkins obviously is a very wealthy institution. It could have done that, but instead they do what all capitalist forces do, is that they use the state, they use the police to contain poverty and control population than to actually liberate people and give people more control.
Does the UPP engage with the, do you, I mean, like, so I think I understand, you know, you've laid out the platform, but do you all engage local politicians? Do you all do policy work directly? Do you work with, or do you try to politically educate and build within other organizations in the community that would then themselves try to apply pressure? How do you all engage as an organization on these kinds of issues?
Directly, we don't really engage politics. And I'm not saying that we won't. I think it's a relative question of strength when that would happen. I think there are obviously people in Baltimore area who have really good institutional capacity to deal with public policy. That's what they do. There are organizations who have those kind of connections. I think we can influence those forces more directly about what we think should happen. I think there needs to be a combination policy, tactic. There needs to be public policy think tanks and people who do that kind of work, but it needs to be undergirded by, you know, educating the masses, right? Going into communities, educating people, making sure there's real understanding about what these political questions are. So as politicians and public policy people engage them, they start to hear a recurring theme of what we want, how we want it, what it looks like. If there's a double cross that happens, you know that there's a base of people who have been educated around these questions who can mobilize and move on individual politicians and policy people, right, to force a situation.
So let me kind of, you know, let me without prior planning or your permission, try to drag you into one of my classroom projects. So this semester, I'm going to be working with some students trying to begin at least the building of a Black media ecology of Baltimore. That is, how do Black residents of Baltimore actually engage media? Yeah. What media do folks check out for news, for whatever, right? So that's one part of the project. Another part of the project is to try to assess the way issues that are important to various organizations working in Baltimore are discussed or carried in those same media outlets. So if more or less, like, I know Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, one of their key issues this year is one is the defund the police slogan, but I know that they're involved also in the legalization of marijuana and a couple other policies that we're going to be checking for in terms of how they're covered in the news. So would this issue of Hopkins taking over public housing be something that the UPP is particularly focused on? So in other words, if my class was looking to work with UPP or support a UPP inspired wing of the project, would that be an issue, or are there other issues that you are more prominently concerned about as they in terms of Baltimore specifically or Maryland even that our class could get involved in trying to assess in terms of the way they're discussed, those issues are discussed in the media that you all engage?
Yeah, absolutely. So that is definitely a good example, because there is organization happening at the grassroots level of housing residents, organized resident advisory board members who've reached out to each other. And we're involved with that process. I think they obviously need access to media to be able to, so voices can be heard that the media are not covering. I think there are nuances in these discussions that often don't get covered by the ruling class press, right? They want to make it as simplistic as possible and as favorable as possible to the ruling class interests about what's happening. So that's key. There's work that we're doing around the law enforcement officer's bill of rights that needs to be completely abolished. Even the discussion around defund the police needs to be better understood, right? Because we support it as a concept, but what does it mean? Right? Because listen, we live in a city that's dangerous. We live in a city that's dangerous. And so there are people who are scared. And you got to respect the fact that working class people are afraid. But the answer isn't just to get more police, because we know it doesn't work. We have to help people understand, when you say defund, what do you really mean? We want to create a more secure situation with the funding. And you got to engage people. And you're going to have to engage people who don't understand these questions, who might push back. But damn it, you live in a community that's already dangerous. Police have failed you. This policy that we're talking about hasn't failed you. You just have to understand it so we can push it forward, right? And I also think that even in this discussion about what other think tanks are doing, we think it's possible for that kind of work to influence and be influenced by what we do and the kind of working class relationships that we're trying to build, so that when we produce candidates who run, they have a wealth of knowledge and access to resources to say, listen, we say that defunding works because here's where it worked at other, in other places. Here's what it can look like. And we're talking about real working class candidates, not just people who say I represent the working class, but I'm talking about the mothers who, there are sisters right now who find a way to make programs happen every year, don't get no grant money, right? Don't have no support. Gotta knuckle up on some official to do what they promised the year before to get it for the children and for the community. Those need to be the leadership that we are putting forward. We need to help develop that kind of leadership model, right? Because it's out there struggling for legitimacy. They just need the kind of resources that a working class movement can organize and build. And if they don't win election again, you're already building power. That's what we're trying to do, right? And that's community to community, working class people working together. So yes, definitely. There are definitely projects like that that need to have that venue to grow.
In fact, the Law Officer Bill of Rights is one of the LBS issues we're going to be looking at too. So we can definitely... And I would encourage anyone watching to check out the discussion we had with Lawrence Grand Prix of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle around the defund the police issue. It was a fascinating discussion. And he I think to your point, Namdi, talks a lot about the nuances and the question of what do we mean when people say that, and what is the connection between the more prominent nonprofits that promote the slogan and the actual people in the communities who are impacted by changes in policing, and not all of whom are on board or fully in agreement or on the same page with, you know, so anyway, I would encourage that. And to your other point, and anyone watching or who will see this later, if this platform, which we invite people to become members of and support because it will be expanding very shortly, if this platform can ever be of help to the voices that you're talking about, you know, put us in touch. We're happy to try to help in any way we can. I know I certainly would be happy to do that. And so anyway, I just saw this. Where Robin Kelly is talking about gentrification is a modern form of settler colonialism, and we are endeavoring, by the way, to get Professor Kelly here, and that's one of the many interviews that hasn't been fully locked down yet, but I gotta say, and maybe I'll ask him about this, because to me this is a softer version of what one of my favorite teachers, Dr. James Turner, was saying in classrooms I was sitting in the early 90s, well the early 2000s rather, that gentrification is just a modern day or a modern rather example of neo-colonialism. It's not even just racial capitalism. It's a colonial, how did he used to put it? It's colonial removal, or displacement of an internally held colony, as I think he was putting it. So anyway, shout out to Dr. James Turner in the Africana Studies and Research Center at Cornell University. And shout out to Mac and Goddess Crew for becoming new members of the channel. Thank you very much. Again, I promise you, and feel free to check up on us. This is not about any individual, you know, the financial support is not about my pockets or anybody else's with the crew. We are really trying to expand something. So that's what that's for. That's the only reason why that this channel was monetized, so that we can try to raise some funds and try to build out some media work that that really isn't happening, or not a lot of people are doing, despite all the media that is produced. Anyway, Nnamdi, I really appreciate your time. I've run through my list of questions. I don't necessarily see any that I'm missing, but I want to, if you've seen something you want to raise or something you want to raise that I haven't brought you to, I'm not rushing you off. I'm just letting you know I've gone through my list, but I want to make sure that if there's anything else that you want us to discuss or you want to make known or repeat, including contact information, please do. But yeah.
Yeah, so I definitely want to say, well, one of the things is, especially with this dispersal that's happening out of both Baltimore City, indirectly, the dispersal of African people out of Washington, D.C. into like surrounding PG County, Montgomery County regions, you're starting to see—
Even Howard County.
Howard County, yes. You're starting to see new pools of where Black people, Black working class people are showing up, right? And again, there's wherever there's going to be oppression, there's going to be resistance. One of the things that we've clearly started to learn is that we have to not only build our base based in Central Maryland, where we're strongest, but also reaching out to the organizational capacity that exists in Western Maryland, Eastern Shore, right, Southern Maryland, because there's always somebody you know historically who's always been that rabble rouser, right, that person who fought back, who stood up. Right. How do we connect to those people? How do we get together? How do we support? Just like we're talking about supporting the kind of work that happens on the grassroots level here that we're doing. How do we support that same level of effort somewhere else? Because if you're in Western Maryland, Eastern Shore, you're up against certain kind of social forces in capitalism. Right. That don't play certain kind of games. It's not neocolonialism. You're dealing with direct, you know, white supremacy in a lot of those places. In its most naked form. And obviously we have this feeling of all the numbers, we kind of feel emboldened, right? But in some, I mean, we sent forces out a couple of years ago to Eastern Shore and we got locked up for being in a demonstration that would have never, the kind of arrest that we took in Eastern Shore would have never happened in Baltimore City, because the numbers would have never allowed for that kind of arrest and the way it went down. And it happened to us. And we realized that things happen very differently in different parts of the state. We need to mobilize Black radical left forces to be able to help these comrades, these brothers and sisters who are doing this kind of work, right? We need to provide the same level of education and training, resources, right, that's going on. The question of the Leo Bill is a statewide question. It's not a Baltimore City question. It's not a Prince George's question. It's a statewide question. So we have to
What bill was that?
The Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, Leo. Yeah, law enforcement. It's actually a series of bills, right? It's not one package. It's a bunch of laws that over the last 20, 30 years have really made it very hard to deal with the police. I mean, ultimately, we believe in community control of policing, right? Policing that we create for our own community to intervene, right? But also the ability to control the police officers that the state has, their funding, their policies. We want to be able to have that influence. The Law Enforcement Bill of Rights right now make that really difficult to do in the state of Maryland, right, realistically. So that's one thing. How do we expand out? Because we have to have a broad left Black movement that's around these radical working class questions. We're also a part of that same process nationally and internationally. We're members of the Black Alliance of Peace, right? And we are able to reach out to other organizations who have different specialities, right, than specialties than we do. But we're able to come together based upon our strength, not our weakness, right? We're looking at other organizations say, this is what you do well. And you believe in the leadership of the working class and the central question that capitalism and imperialism has to go, right? Because of that kind of relationship, we can participate in national formations, right? Like the Black Alliance for Peace, and be able to say, yes, let's move forward, right? And these are working relationships. We don't always agree on every position, but we do know that at the core, these values are what we want. We want to emulate that, like I said, not only at the state level, right? Because we know there are level forces who are answering some of these questions. What does it look like on a national level as well, right? So we have to, that's the reason why our political education process is ongoing, because we have to elevate our community's political understanding, right? People have to be able to have debates and discussions based upon being informed, right? So much of what happens in politics depends upon people being uninformed, right? I mean, I ran one time, and I remember 2016, I ran an interesting campaign because the guy who eventually won was very concerned about our policy. He thought that it was going to be tight, and it wasn't. What we learned and have seen again and again is that what independent candidates run up against is not the individual candidate, but the political machinery of the Democratic Party, the political machinery of the Republican Party, right? Organized oppression has to be met by organized resistance. People in opposition cannot continue to do things that don't work. We have to build organizational capacity. We have to be able to build a party so people can join it and be a part of building a machine. So when you run candidates, if you know you got 500 people, 1,000 people in a district, you already know those votes are counted for. Those are resources. Those are house parties. Those are block parties. Those are mamas talking to their children. Right? That's neighbors talking to neighbors. I'm a member of this organization. You should vote because that's what the machine looks like. Because when we run in Maryland, most Democrats don't even run in the general election. They don't do anything because it's in the bag. They don't even send you mailings to tell you to vote. What the party does is they send you vote for the top of the ticket. And oh, by the way, vote for these sellouts that we just gave you for the city council. Right? So again, we want people to understand that we have to build institutional capacity as a Black working class organization. It's not based upon winning elections. It's about based on winning power in our communities. And when you have power, you translate that in your economic decisions, your political decisions, your social decisions, but you have to build power. Check us out on Facebook, uppmaryland.org as well.
Yeah, we've put the link in the description to the YouTube and to the post that will go up at imixwhatilike.org eventually. Namdi, again, I just want to say publicly, you know, I apologize for being so long between our last conversation and this one. And I don't want it to go too long before the next one. So
I helped you a little bit and say thank you for your previous financial support. We know that you're there because we see that you support the work that we're doing. So we know.
I mean, I'm trying to support a lot of different folks, but you know, I obviously I want to do more, and I love hearing the analysis. So I mean, just even selfishly, I don't want to go this long before we talk again because
certainly, absolutely, we need to.
So much whackness out here that it's hard to, you know. Anyway, so. Shout out to again Ian Scott, Sister Mayada Kandaka Manan Break. I hope I got that at least close. I appreciate you joining and becoming a new member. I promise you, an announcement is, you know, maybe within another day or two, it's coming. We're going to build this thing out and continue to try to do so. So that Namdi and the work that he and his comrades are doing have at least one more strong platform to go to. And maybe we can start putting some journalists in their spaces as we start to get past this lockdown situation eventually. So anyway, man, I appreciate you, Namdi Lumumba of the Ujima People's Progress Party, UPP. Anytime you need a spot, please send folks our way, and we got you. And thanks for your work, and appreciate you joining me this morning.
Thank you. We're going to get on the ballot this year. Uhuru Sasa.
All right, right on. Uhuru Sasa. All right. Thank you to Namdi Lumumba. Thanks to all of you again for joining me this morning, joining us this morning. Really appreciate it. Again, as always, as I tell people all the time, we have, relatively speaking to some platforms, we have a small but thoughtful audience and a vigorous, discussion group or a group of discussants in the chat. I really appreciate it. I'm going to go back and check what I missed and try to respond to some if I can later on. Please do like, share, and subscribe. Thanks again to those who joined. Thanks to those who will consider joining going forward this channel. And come on back in a couple of hours when we're joined by Dr. Kemet Shockley for a discussion of African-centered education and the new series that he and his colleague have put together for WHUT here in Washington, D.C., or the road in Washington, D.C., and for PBS nationally called The Movement. So anyway, much more coming up here at I Mix What I Like Live. Please check out imixwhatilike.org for all of the work that we get done across multimedia, beyond these live streams and beyond obviously just me. And we will catch you next time. And as always, as Fred Hampton used to say to you, we say peace if you're willing to fight for it. So peace, everybody. Catch you next time right here on Mix What I Like Live.
I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like. I mix what I like, what I like, what I like, what I like.